KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Old technology leads to a communications failure at Newark's airport, with air traffic controllers unable to talk to planes during an outage. What kinds of upgrades does a system need? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump says his tariffs could cause families to cut back on toys as their prices rise. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. We hear from the CEO making Tonka trucks and Care Bears about how much prices could go up. Also, a lawsuit asks whether the federal government can freeze funding because of the way environmental project is talked about. It's Wednesday, May 7th. On this day in 2004, marine biologist Richard Thompson published an academic paper with a new term for the debris cluttering up the world's oceans. The term, microplastics. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Roman Catholic cardinals have gathered at the Vatican to undertake the selection of the next pope. NPR's Jason DeRose reports on the papal conclave.
The order of the day. A morning mass in St. Peter's Basilica, the only event that's public. Then a gathering of the cardinal electors clad in their scarlet and white robes in the Vatican's Pauline Chapel. A procession from there to the Sistine Chapel while singing the Litany of Saints with the refrain, Save Us, Lord. Once inside, under Michelangelo's creation fresco, the cardinals sing the ancient hymn, Veni Creator Spiritus. They swear an oath, hands touching the Gospels. A master of ceremonies declares extra omnes, sending out those not involved in the election. Cardinals hear one final sermon, then the voting begins. Jason DeRose, NPR News, Rome.
India has fired missiles at several targets in Pakistan. They're the most significant strikes in more than 50 years. India is blaming Pakistan for a militant attack last month that killed 26 Indian tourists. They were in the Indian-controlled part of Kashmir province. Pakistan denies responsibility. NPR's Dia Hadid says India is claiming its military response is appropriate.
India's army says it struck militant training camps and what they call terror infrastructure, and many of those strikes were in Pakistani-held Kashmir. Kashmir is that Himalayan territory divided between India and Pakistan. It's claimed by both, and it's at the heart of nearly every conflict between the two countries. But Pakistan says the strikes mostly hit mosques and part of a hydropower dam.
NPR's Dia Hadid reporting. Pakistan claims it shot down Indian warplanes, but that has not been confirmed. A U.S. official has confirmed to NPR the Trump administration is planning to fly migrants to Libya. It's another step in its illegal immigration crackdown. The official was not authorized to speak publicly about the plans. Some prior efforts to send migrants to countries they're not from have been repeatedly challenged in courts. The administration has already flown migrants to El Salvador, where they're being held in a maximum security prison. Stocks open higher this morning as the U.S. and China prepare for high-level trade talks. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
The U.S. Treasury Secretary and Trade Representative will meet their Chinese counterparts in Geneva over the weekend. It's the first such face-to-face meeting since President Trump imposed a triple-digit tax on nearly all Chinese imports. Cargo shipments from China to the U.S. have dropped sharply since those tariffs took effect last month. Containers arriving at the Port of Los Angeles this week are down about 35% from this time last year. The Federal Reserve is taking stock of the economic fallout from the trade war as policymakers wrap up their two-day meeting in Washington today. For now, the Fed's expected to hold interest rates steady, but investors will be listening for any clues about possible interest rate changes in the months to come. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. Four women have accused R&B singer Smokey Robinson of sexual assault over many years. The unidentified women have filed a lawsuit in Los Angeles seeking millions in damages. They say they worked for Robinson as housekeepers in L.A. and in Las Vegas. They also allege that he assaulted them. They accuse Robinson's wife of failing to prevent the attacks. The singer, who is now 85, has not issued a statement. The world is still emitting too much climate-warming methane, according to a new report from the International Energy Agency. NPR's Jeff Brady reports fossil fuel companies are one of the largest sources of methane pollution.
With global temperatures at record highs for 2 years in a row, reducing methane pollution can limit future global heating. That's because methane is an even more potent climate warmer than carbon dioxide. Tim Gould with the International Energy Agency says fossil fuel companies are making slow progress.
We estimate that only around 5% of global oil and gas production can credibly demonstrate that they meet a near zero methane emissions standard.
The IEA projects that even with Trump administration deregulation policies, U.S. methane emissions will decline 35% by the end of the decade because of state and individual company methane reduction goals. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
There won't be a Triple Crown winner this year in horse racing. The trainer for the winner of the Kentucky Derby, Sovereignty, says the horse won't compete in the Preakness next week. But Sovereignty is expected to race in the Belmont Stakes in June. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. For several days now, hundreds of flights have been delayed or canceled at Newark Liberty International Airport, one of the nation's busiest. That's in part because of a technology failure that caused air traffic controllers to lose contact with a plane. Officials are calling for a remake of the air traffic system. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a former air traffic controller, now with the Airlines Trade Group. But first, NPR's Jacqueline Diaz is here with more on what's been happening. Thanks for joining us, Jacqueline.
Yeah, of course.
So give us a breakdown of the latest issues at Newark. What's been going on and how bad is it?
Yeah, so this has been going on for several days where hundreds of flights are canceled and delayed in and out of that airport. Last night, FlightAware, a flight tracking website, reported more than 370 flights were delayed Tuesday and around 500 were canceled. And yesterday, passengers were waiting for hours to get on their flights. But basically, there are several issues hitting Newark. Bad weather is one. The airport's busiest runway is closed until June for renovation. And as we know, there's a shortage of air traffic controllers around the country. Newark is no exception. About a week ago, controllers lost all radar and communications with the plane. That left them unable to hear or talk to the pilots. And Bloomberg News reported the blackout lasted for 90 seconds, which is a lifetime when you're talking about planes coming in for a landing. A number of controllers were pretty shaken up by this and other recent outages and have gone on leave to deal with the stress and trauma. Now, there's not enough people to bring planes in and out of one of the nation's busiest airports.
And people might also remember that there have been a number of high-profile crashes and close calls since the beginning of the year. We're talking about at other airports, and now we have the situation at Newark. So how are authorities responding?
pretty aggressively. The Federal Aviation Administration says the April 28th incident was not the only reported communications blackout that controllers experienced in Newark recently. And yesterday, Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said the issues at the airport just show the nation's air traffic control system is badly in need of updating. He said that later this week, the administration will present a new plan to do just that.
Okay, so what do we know about this plan?
So a huge part of this plan will involve updating the technology and equipment air traffic controllers use. Duffy shared some details about the state of technology right now, and he was speaking outside the White House.
So the air traffic control system that we use today is anywhere from 25 to 50 years old. We have copper wires, not fiber. We use radar that is, 1983 vintage at the earliest.
This plan also involves getting more controllers trained and working to ease that lingering staffing problem, but we are still many years from filling those gaps.
So I think people listening to us will want to know, is it safe to fly?
Experts I spoke to said our air traffic control system leads with safety at the top of mind. Hassan Shahidi with the Flight Safety Foundation had this to say.
We have controllers that are trained and doing their jobs well. We have pilots that are trained and they're doing their jobs very well.
Okay, so before we let you go, look, this is the time of year. A lot of people have trips and vacations planned. Newark is a major hub. If that's your situation, what should people do right now?
An expert I spoke to suggested folks look at their airline's website for travel advisories before going to the airport. And those airlines may be offering passengers the chance to switch flights for free to a different airport nearby. And if those travel plans include a connection through Newark to a final destination, it might be best to scrap that for a direct flight.
That's NPR's Jacqueline Diaz. Jacqueline, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, for more on this, we're joined by Paul Rinaldi. He's a former air traffic controller who's now Senior Vice President of Operations and Safety with Airlines for America. That's a trade group that lobbies on behalf of airlines. So, Paul, we just heard Jacqueline mention this big overhaul that's coming. What would be the number one upgrade, do you think, is the most critical? Well, the first thing that that Sean Duffy needs to start with.
Well, there's multiple things that Secretary Duffy needs to start with. Obviously, hiring more air traffic controllers would help immediately. And they are really focused on putting 3,000 air traffic controllers through the academy this year. In addition, he spoke about the copper wires. You want to make sure that we can get to fiber optic wires throughout our entire system. Unfortunately, the Newark failure that we had the other day is not the only failure we have. We have failures throughout the system with these archaic copper wires all the time.
Now let's hear from Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy. Here he is talking about all that on Tuesday on Martha McCallum's show on Fox News.
What we have right now is the old school flip phone. You can't update the flip phone, Martha. You can send as many updates as you want, but it doesn't update.
Paul, is that a fair comparison, the U.S. air traffic control system like a flip phone?
It's a very fair comparison. If you look at the technology we're using, most of it is from the late 1980s to the 1990s. We still use floppy disks to update our information system. We still have paper strips that we walk around the tower cab with that each controller writes something on and then hands it to the next controller. It is, it's archaic when you think about the technology that's out there that's being used around the world. He's exactly right. We have to upgrade the system.
How did it get this way? Because, I mean, people had to have known, right, after a few years that, hey, we're falling behind. Like, this can't be as up to date as we can be.
Yeah, it's been decades in the making. There's been a lot of bells that have been rung that we must do better. Really, there's a lot of blame to go around. But when you look at the funding structure for our aviation system, you can't have these threats of government shutdowns and these government shutdowns continuously to negatively impact the aviation system. That's what's been happening since basically 2008. We watched the FAA go through either shutdowns or threats of shutdowns at an average of three times a year. That puts the hiring, the training, and modernization back on its heels every 3 to 4 months.
So all that politicking then, I mean, that's the consequences, right? That people can't modernize, people can't get hired, people just basically stalled. We're like stuck in time when it comes to this air traffic control system.
Yeah, our air traffic control system is, high functioning. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, it doesn't need to be interrupted by the threats of government shutdowns. It needs to have stable, predictable funding so we can continue to modernize the system and give the American people the best, safest system in the world.
Now, United is a member of your group, Airlines for America. United CEO Scott Kirby put out a message to customers last week saying 20% of Newark controllers, quote, walked off the job. Given your background, Paul, I mean, is that an accurate description of what really happened?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what happened in that trach on that day. I've heard anything from 30 seconds to 90 seconds. It is very concerning that if a controller can't confirm exactly where that airplane is on the radar scope, if the scope is freezing or jumping along with static on a frequency where you can't accurately communicate with the pilots, it becomes very nerve-wracking to air traffic controllers.
Have you gotten a sense from people? I mean, people fly and they're going to keep flying, and it is, you know, a very, very safe way to travel overall. But have you gotten a sense from people that the trust in the airline business at all components is maybe not as strong as it used to be?
Well, listen, aviation is the safest form of flying, safest form of transportation by far, right? So flying is safe. The fact that we're experiencing that we're experiencing these delays in Newark, obviously there's construction on the airport that has a negative impact on how many airplanes you can depart and arrive at that airport. So what happens is the system slows down so that we ensure the safety of the system and the flying public.
All right. Paul Rinaldi is a former air traffic controller who's now with the trade group Airlines for America. Paul, thanks.
Appreciate your time.
Sudan's wartime capital city, Port Sudan, is under attack. Drones bombed the city for the past 4 days. They were launched by the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, which is at war with Sudan's army. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu has this report.
A show of defiance by Sudan's leader. On Tuesday, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan stood on the roadside in Port Sudan with plumes of smoke from a drone strike in the backdrop. In Arabic, he promised that the shocking attacks on the city would be avenged. For the last 4 days, including this morning, drone strikes have struck military and civilian targets, including the airport, hotels, and an oil depot. Port Sudan became the temporary capital after fighting ignited in the capital Khartoum. The city and Sudan's Red Sea state hosts about 250,000 refugees. It's been one of the few places where some among the 15 million people displaced have been able to feel safe and rebuild something of a life. Now that has been upended. Sudan's information minister Khalid Alezi went to the scene of one of the strikes at an oil depot. The country would fight the RSF, he said, and their backers, the United Arab Emirates. On Tuesday, Sudan cut diplomatic ties with the UAE, who it blames for arming the RSF, backed by mounting evidence from rights groups and UN experts. The UAE strongly denies this.
These attacks on Port Sudan represent a clear scaling up of the war.
Cameron Hudson is a senior associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. In March, the army recaptured Khartoum and much of central Sudan, welcomed by millions in the country desperate to return.
What we are seeing is the RSF really doubling down on its attack, trying to reclaim lost territory and sending a message that no place is safe.
And he said the UAE is a key actor in the war.
For months now, there have been reports that the UAE has been providing weapons to the RSF. There are even UN reports documenting these weapons transfers. But in the face of all of this evidence, the UAE continues to simply deny that it has any role in this conflict.
Port Sudan is the main entry point for aid in the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. Now that could worsen, and a dangerous shift in the war has ended any sense of sanctuary in Sudan. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how the Trump family's business ventures capitalize on the president's position and stand to directly benefit him. This includes foreign deals from luxury hotels in Dubai and Serbia to the Trump cryptocurrency company. New York Times reporter Eric Lipton tells us why these deals pose unprecedented conflicts of interest. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. At progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Kresge Foundation, established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at kresge.org. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Toy makers are saying that what President Trump predicted might happen as a result of his tariffs might come true.
Maybe the children will have two dolls instead of 30 dolls, you know? And maybe the two dolls will cost a couple of bucks more than they would normally.
This week, the CEO of Mattel, which makes Barbie, warned about increasing prices. So we're going to hear from another CEO, Jay Foreman of Basic Fun. You will recognize a lot of their toys, Care Bears, Tonka Trucks, Lincoln Logs, and Light Bright. And Jay Foreman is with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I understand that about 80% of the toys you manufacture come from China. As briefly as you can, why is that?
It's because, you know, the industry moved from the U.S. in the 80s. I started in a toy factory in Brooklyn, New York, and that factory moved to Korea in the late 80s and then into China in the 90s, and the whole industry basically migrated there about 30, 40 years ago.
So what have the tariffs, in particular the tariffs on China, meant for your company?
Well, it's meant we've, you know, really frozen our shipments. We're not able to ship, or we're not really shipping out of China right now, because the 145% tariff would basically double the price of all toys. And the market, you know, at this point is not sustaining and not accepting the fact that the cost of the products are going to double on shelf. So they're waiting in China and waiting around the world, hoping that these tariffs start to come down.
So look, I'm looking online at a certain website where people buy a lot of stuff. I don't have to say what it is.
Heard of it.
Right, you've heard of it. Okay, so I'm looking at a Tonka truck right now, like the classic dump truck. It's like listed right now for about $25. So you're saying if you were to bring more toys in, that would cost $50?
Yes.
So, and you think people just aren't going to pay that?
Well, you know, they may pay it, but it'll be a lot fewer people will pay it, because when everything's doubling, you know, your budget only goes halfway. And it's not just for toys, everything else, many, many other things in the supply chain that you buy in places like Walmart and Target or your corner store, they're all going to go up. So your entire market basket goes up. So, you know, it might not sound like a lot to spend another 10 or 15 or 20 bucks for a toy, but everything in your shopping basket goes up, and then it really starts to hurt the consumer.
But I mean, you're talking about a $25 truck, Tonka truck, just for sake of, you know, hypothetical. $10, $15?
No, another $25.
Another $25. So you're talking about $50 for a toy dump truck. You know, the CEO of the Toy Association and Industry Group has pointed out that this is sort of logical, but maybe people don't think about this, that toys are made several months before they're sold in the U.S. He actually said that Christmas is at risk. Is that true?
Well, Christmas is very much at risk. I think, you know, parents will always find something for their child, even if they have to make it, you know, themselves, you know, arts and crafts, they'll make it. There'll be things on the shelves. The real crisis is, how about all the moms and dads who work for those companies, or those are their companies? Will they have a Christmas, because they might not have a business, they might not have a job? And that's the knock-on effect of all these things. Truck drivers not picking up at the ports, warehouse workers not unloading, store clerks, shipping not happening, sales not happening, income not happening, people get laid off, businesses close. That's the real danger. Okay. People will find things to buy for themselves and their kids, but there's going to be a tremendous amount of damage along the way.
Before we let you go, just as 30 seconds left, are any of your toys made in the U.S.? What would it take to move the rest of the product line here?
We make things like Lincoln Logs and Kinects and Tinker Toys here in the U.S. We've got a plan. We're trying to work with the president, and we've got a plan to build an operation here in the United States to make some of the products. You can't make them all, but that will take 3 or 4 years to set that up. So we're hoping to see some relief in the meantime so we can save Christmas.
That is the founder and CEO of Basic Fun, Jay Foreman. Thank you so much for talking with us. Let's keep in touch. Tell us how it's going.
We sure will. Thank you.
How do you smell this morning? Didn't mean for it to sound that creepy. Now, maybe you spritz on some perfume.
A little personal, eh?
Cologne to get the day started. That could be one of life's nice little extras, but it does come at a price.
A bottle of the good stuff could easily run you $200 or more. Turns out, though, there are cheaper versions known as dupes.
Some of the dupes are so close to the original that even professionals would have difficulty telling them apart.
That's Victoria Belim-Frlova, a perfumer based in Brussels. She's seeing a growing number of scents that mimic more expensive originals.
I think we see a lot of this explosion thanks to TikTok and YouTube and kind of the younger generation of perfume wearers who are using dupes almost as this way to rebel against the prestige established market.
So these aren't exact knockoffs of a brand perfume. Companies that make dupes advertise them as being inspired by more expensive alternatives. Sergio Take is the founder of Dossier. That's a company that makes dupes.
The younger generation aspires to discover fragrance more and wear different perfumes in different circumstances. It's hard to do that when, if you want to buy three perfumes, you got to pay a couple hundred dollars at your local perfume store to have that wardrobe of scents.
Dossier's dupe of MFK's Baccarat Rouge 540 costs $49. A smaller bottle of the real MFK scent will set you back $210.
Perfumers are artists. They are phenomenal creators, and we respect their work a ton. But I also think there's a place for companies like ours who create great perfumes for a more affordable price.
Fragrance makers have used technology to analyze competitors' products for a long time, but Belim-Frlova says using it to basically copy another scent is going too far.
It's taking advantage of someone else's creativity, of someone else's success, and feeding on that. So it does not have any artistic value.
Kieran Flanagan is an influencer who posts about cologne as Fragrance Flan on TikTok. He says he spends a lot of his paycheck on fragrances, and he's not a fan of dupes.
If their goal when you hear them marketing it is, this is one for one, it smells identical to this, then I'm like, I'll just buy the other one at that point.
You know, Michelle, I've never worn cologne or aftershave. Not once. Just rubbing alcohol. Just rubbing alcohol after a shave. Yep.
Okay, well, if that works for you.
I'm talking like that. This is NPR News.
One of the challenges that the conclave's selection for Pope will face is how to make the Catholic Church appealing and relevant to future generations.
Whenever the church moves forward, it does so by looking back and drawing on the best of its tradition.
I'm Elsa Chang, how young Catholics are thinking about the church during the papal transition on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Roman Catholic Cardinal electors will soon be assembling at the Sistine Chapel to begin the process of selecting a new pope. NPR's Ruth Sherlock says earlier today they attended morning mass at St. Peter's Basilica.
The cardinals in blood-red robes processed up the aisle of the crowded St. Peter's Basilica, passing the bishops in their deep purple gowns and stopping briefly at the altar to pray. White smoke from the burning frankincense curled up towards the golden cupola, the air filled with the music from the choir as they led the congregation in prayerful song. "We are here to invoke the help of the Holy Spirit," said Cardinal Battista Re in his homily, "so that the Pope elected may be he whom the Church and humanity need at this difficult and complex turning point in history." Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, St. Peter's Basilica in Vatican City.
Pope Francis died last month at the age of 88 following a stroke. A U.S. official tells NPR the Trump administration is planning to deport migrants to Libya as part of the administration's crackdown on illegal immigration. The official was not authorized to speak publicly. Human rights advocates have described conditions at migrant detention centers in Libya as horrific. This is NPR News. China is criticizing efforts by the CIA to recruit informants. As NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports, Beijing and Washington have stepped up counterintelligence efforts against each other amid deteriorating bilateral ties.
Last week, the CIA posted two Chinese language videos. In one of them, a Chinese official who is disillusioned by domestic politics decides to contact the CIA. The video comes with instructions on how to reach out to the agency via a secure internet portal. Speaking through a translator, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Lin Jian called the video a political provocation.
"We will take all measures necessary to resolutely crack down on infiltration and sabotage activities by anti-China forces outside China."
The CIA sees China as both a top priority and a hard target for its spies to infiltrate. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
State police in Idaho say last week's deadly crash involving a pickup truck and a tour van was caused by the driver of the pickup crossing the center line and slamming into the van. That crash left 7 people dead, 6 tourists aboard the van, all but one from China, and the driver of the pickup. The crash occurred on Highway 20 near Yellowstone National Park. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 240 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Workday. Workday is an HR and finance platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to propelling organizations, workforces, and industries into the future. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The U.S. Supreme Court has allowed the Trump administration to begin executing its ban on transgender military service members, at least for now. Joining us to talk about this is NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Now, Nina, President Trump has been trying to ban transgender troops in the military since his first administration. What's the difference between then and now?
In the first Trump term, he partially succeeded, but the ban was reversed by President Biden, only to be put back in place by Trump after he took office for a second term. This new order mimics the Trump order from the first administration and appears to strengthen it as well, barring transgender individuals from enlisting and discharging active duty transgender service members.
All right, so what did the Supreme Court do yesterday?
In a one-paragraph unsigned order, the justices revived the transgender ban, which had been temporarily blocked by the lower courts. The court's three liberal justices, Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson, noted their dissents and would have barred the administration from putting the ban in place while the case continues to be litigated in the lower courts. So the case now goes back to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for the Trump policy to be reviewed.
You know, there's been a lot of back and forth in this case since 2016. That's when the Obama administration first allowed openly trans individuals to serve in the military. So how is the new policy different?
The Obama policy was reversed by Trump in 2017, followed by new rules issued by then Defense Secretary James Mattis. The Mattis rules allowed exceptions to the ban for active service members previously diagnosed with gender dysphoria. But the new policy, the Trump 2 policy, is significantly tougher because it bars from the military anyone with a gender dysphoria diagnosis. And while that isn't everyone, it is most trans individuals.
Now, where are things now?
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals will take a whack at deciding the issue, and that decision can be appealed to the Supreme Court, though the ban is likely to remain in place during the appellate process.
So let me cut to the chase here. What are the chances that the Supreme Court will ultimately rule against the Trump trans ban in the military?
Probably slim to none. The fact is that the Supreme Court, even on a temporary basis, has allowed the Trump administration to proceed with carrying out the ban. And that's a pretty strong indicator that the administration is very likely to prevail in the long run.
When it comes to the numbers of people, how many trans individuals are in the military right now under the policy that allowed them to enlist and serve?
According to the Pentagon, about 0.2% of active military forces, or about 4,000 individuals.
So, Nina, I'm wondering, who are the plaintiffs that brought this challenge?
They're a group of current and aspiring transgender service members, including lead plaintiff Emily Schilling, a Navy pilot who's flown more than 60 combat missions over her nearly two decades of military service. Ruling in their favor, Judge Benjamin Settle in Washington State, who's a George W. Bush appointee, concluded that the government's classification of gender dysphoria as a disqualifying medical condition was essentially a ruse motivated by hostility towards transgender people.
So, safe to say that the Supreme Court will eventually actually rule on this?
Probably the case will come back to the court next term for a final ruling, regardless of who wins in the Ninth Circuit.
All right, that's NPR's Nina Totenberg. Nina, thanks.
My pleasure.
A lawsuit in South Carolina asks a question about the Trump administration's cuts to grants and funding for climate projects. Can the government strip away money from a community project because of the language used to talk about it? Cities and nonprofits allege in the case that Trump's funding freeze violates their free speech rights. NPR's Michael Copley has more.
Steve Winter's in charge of climate and sustainability programs for the city of New Haven, Connecticut. Until recently, he was working on replacing old heating systems in lower-income neighborhoods with heat pumps. It was a chance to cut air pollution and heat-trapping emissions.
But you can also reduce heating bills in the winter and provide a source of air conditioning, high-efficiency air conditioning in the summer.
Then in March, the Environmental Protection Agency terminated grant funding for the project. It's part of a broader effort by the Trump administration to purge environmental justice initiatives, which are aimed at helping poor and disadvantaged communities, including communities of color.
I don't think we should be penalized for focusing on those neighborhoods and trying to help residents in those areas improve their health outcomes and lower their energy bills.
Now, New Haven's among several cities and nonprofits from around the country suing the Trump administration in South Carolina federal court. So far, most other lawsuits over funding freezes have rested on the Constitution's separation of powers. They argue the administration can't withhold money Congress already approved. The South Carolina case goes further. It says the administration violated the group's First Amendment rights by targeting the plaintiffs over language in their grant documents, words like equity and socioeconomic. Harvard University is making a similar argument in its lawsuit against the administration over funding that's been withheld.
You can't use government funding to coerce speech.
That's Kim Meyer, litigation director at the Southern Environmental Law Center, which represents the nonprofits in the South Carolina case. The EPA declined to comment on pending litigation. The agency previously has said it's trying to redirect some grant funding to projects that fit the administration's priorities. But Meyer says in the South Carolina case,
the facts show that that's not true.
A court filing in the lawsuit includes a copy of an email between an EPA employee and the head of a South Carolina nonprofit whose grant funding has been frozen and unfrozen repeatedly. Attached to the email was a document the EPA employee referred to as a list of words to avoid, and another the employee called a sanitized work plan. Also in the court filing is a document that appears to direct government employees to flag grant materials containing keywords that may conflict with President Trump's executive orders.
What they're saying to this group is, oh, it's probably fine for you to spend this money on this affordable housing in Charleston as planned, but we want you to talk about it differently. And that isn't something that the government can do.
What's at stake is the concept of viewpoint neutrality, which is a bedrock of the First Amendment, says Nadine Strawson, a senior fellow at the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. She isn't involved in the South Carolina case. Strawson says groups don't have a right to federal funding, but the government can't deny or remove funding because it disagrees with the group's ideas or perspectives.
No matter who you are, and no matter what your most important beliefs are, there will be a time and a government official, and perhaps a majority of people in your community, who will strongly disapprove of your viewpoint.
And she says it's that principle of viewpoint neutrality that's supposed to keep the government from silencing or punishing people it disagrees with, no matter who's in power. Michael Copley, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
There's a new box set of music by the late, great Patsy Cline. Never before released live recordings from concerts, radio, and TV appearances. Next time, here and now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, me Martinez. A 7-year-old boy in Utah woke up one morning, climbed into his mom's SUV with his 5-year-old sister, and drove off. His mom had said he'd been talking about going to McDonald's. He drove 9 miles before hitting a parking strip. No one was hurt. The boy's mom said he's not in any legal trouble, but that he's probably going to be grounded for the rest of his life or until he gets a commercial license because someday he wants to become a truck driver. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Cardinals celebrated Mass in Vatican City this morning. It was their final public appearance before going to the Sistine Chapel to select a new pope. There, they will sit beneath the ceilings of Michelangelo's paintings of creation. And closed off from the world, they will vote until they have a new leader. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports from outside the Sistine Chapel on the history of the conclave.
From here in St. Peter's Square, I can just about see the chimney that's been set up at the Sistine Chapel. The only way from now on for cardinals to communicate with the outside world. Black smoke means they need more rounds of voting. White smoke means Habemus Papam. We have a new pope. But it wasn't always like this. In fact, this will be only the 26th conclave held inside the Sistine Chapel, and there have been 266 popes.
The conclave in the past could be organized everywhere, not only in Rome, but also outside Rome.
Luciano Galliano works in the immense Vatican Museums, whose 4 miles of galleries, 1,000 rooms, and more than 100,000 artifacts connect through hallways painted with Renaissance frescoes to the Sistine Chapel.
Behind that window, you can see the Sistine Chapel.
As we walk, Galliano tells us the first conclave happened in 1270 in the Italian town of Viterbo, north of Rome. Cardinals were hosted by the city, but more than a year passed, and still they hadn't chosen a new pope.
So imagine 18 months in which you are spending a lot of money to feed and to host the cardinals. So the people of Viterbo decided to close all the cardinals inside the cathedral of Viterbo. They locked the doors. Physically, they made a wall in front of the door so that no one could escape. They removed the roof, and they were feeding the cardinals with water and bread.
In total, after 2 years and 9 months, Gregory X was selected.
The conclave, that is coming from Latin, cum clave, to lock with the key, was officially invented.
We walk through history, passing the Vatican flag that was brought to the moon in 1968 with the Apollo 11 mission, historical maps and ancient compass gauges, until we reach...
Now we are in the Borgia apartment.
For the conclaves at the Sistine Chapel, cardinals would stay here. It's a fantastic, high-ceilinged rooms. The paintings here date back to the 1400s. This is the room of the creed. For all the beauty, Galliano says, staying in these rooms was actually pretty uncomfortable.
In this room there were 6 beds.
And with so many to a room, it was smelly and the snoring under the high ceilings was loud. Few got much sleep. By 1978, the year when cardinals had to stay here for 2 conclaves, they had had enough.
The first dream of John Paul II was to prepare a special space for the future conclaves.
Now the cardinals stay in the much more comfortable Santa Marta guest house at the Vatican.
The Sistine Chapel is completely isolated for the entire duration of the conclave. Everyone has to swear to keep the secret for the entire life.
And just to be sure, the Vatican has installed equipment to jam their phones. The cardinals will pray and talk and vote while millions watch the Sistine Chapel chimney, looking for the white smoke that will signal a new era for the Catholic Church under a new pope. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Thank you. when your bank gets the insurance money.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. The Name Your Price tool provides a range of coverage options. Progressive.com. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. First Weight Watchers wants to slim down its debt, entering Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection to avoid paying $1.2 billion it owes and to get cash to build up its telehealth business to make money writing prescriptions for weight loss drugs.
To understand what Weight Watchers is going through, look to no other than Oprah Winfrey. She joined the company's board a decade ago and became its spokesperson.
Let's let 2016 be the year of our best bodies.
That lasted until, well, last year, when Oprah announced she's now taking a prescription weight loss drug. Lots of people are doing the same. In the first 3 months of this year, Weight Watchers sales for things like nutrition guidance and group workshops fell 10%. The company does offer prescription medications through a telehealth plan, and revenues from that part of its business grew 57% last quarter. Weight Watchers wants to invest to expand its telehealth business. It says restructuring its finances through bankruptcy will eliminate burdensome debt, some dating back decades, and save as much as $50 million a year in interest payments alone. I'm Novosavo for Marketplace.
In 3 hours, we'll hear about interest rates, jobs, inflation, and the economy as seen by the Federal Reserve, which is not expected to adjust interest rates today. The Dow is up 189 points, 0.5%. The S&P up 0.3%. The NASDAQ is up 0.2% now, saying its tariffs. Ford announced today it has raised prices by as much as $2,000 on three models made in Mexico, the Maverick pickup, the Bronco Sport, and the Mustang electric SUV. Amid tougher U.S. border policies, new data point to fewer international students coming to the U.S. for higher education. There's a 13% dip in enrollments in postgraduate programs for the next academic year. This, according to the Association of International Educators. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall has more.
Visa issues and other government policies are the top reason NAFSA CEO Fanta Ah says they're seeing a decline in international enrollment.
The uncertainty that international students currently in the U.S. have experienced have had a ripple effect on prospective students and how they're looking to the U.S.
International students tend to be post-grad, often in STEM fields. Arizona State University's Trevor Thornton teaches several students entering careers in semiconductors.
They're getting interviews at these companies, getting jobs at these companies, but there's a lot of fear. The ones who are a year behind them are wondering what they're going to be doing a year from now.
And Wendy Wolfert with Cornell, where students have dealt with visa revocations, says interest in the school remains strong for now. But
if there were more severe actions and more chaos in the immigration landscape, I think that could have a real effect.
She says these students bring dollars, innovation, and talent to the U.S. I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Gamma. Gamma uses AI to generate presentations, websites, social media, and documents from a single prompt. No design or coding skills required. More at gamma.app. You have ideas, Gamma brings them to life.
The two big Los Angeles area wildfires in January destroyed more than 11,000 homes in addition to businesses and other structures. For those with insurance and a mortgage on burned property came what was probably a new piece of personal finance information. If the insurance company does write a check after a fire, the mortgage lender gets to hold the money until the property owner can show they've reached various stages of rebuilding. And here's the other surprise. The insurance payout money could be hundreds of thousands of dollars or more, pays little if any interest, even if it sits for months or years on hold. A member of the California Assembly, whose district includes one of the centers of the fire, Altadena, is pushing a bill to get more interest to homeowners. I spoke to Assemblyman John Harabedian, a Democrat. Morning.
Thank you for having me.
So we should explain. I mean, who knew? If you're lucky enough to have fire insurance and you're lucky enough to have gotten the insurance company to send some of the money, what happens if the homeowner has a mortgage, owes money to the lender on the property? That check comes to you, but it also comes to somebody else.
That's exactly right, David. If you have a mortgage on your property and you experienced a complete loss, the post-loss insurance payment actually goes to the mortgage lender, and the mortgage lender will hold on to it sometimes for a very long extended period of time. What my bill, AB 493, does is actually make sure that any interest that is earned off of that post-loss insurance payment actually goes to the holder of the policy and isn't kept by the banks.
Yeah, if it's a low interest rate, it might not be that much money, but if I can get a CD, a certificate of deposit for 4%, if I shop around, 4% on $500,000 that maybe the mortgage company is holding for you is 20 grand after just a year, and you might just be starting your rebuild in a year.
That's right. And as anyone in this position knows full well, there are a lot of needs financially, and most people are underwater. They don't have the bank account to pay for everything. They were underinsured. And so anything that we can do to protect the financial rights of these homeowners and of these victims is really critical.
Some people may be saying, how could it be? I don't get interest. But if you look deep in the wording of when you sign the mortgage, there's typically a clause that says this. Your bill would change this. Are you getting traction on that thing?
We're getting a lot of support. I think a lot of people are surprised and confused as to why historically this interest wouldn't go to the homeowner who lost their home. And the governor's office has been extremely supportive. And I'm very confident once it gets to his desk, he will sign it and we will change this.
I was talking to an Altadena homeowner who was on fire about this issue of not getting interest, and he pointed me to a law that changed in the state of Colorado. In fact, it was just signed into law last May that would do what you're trying to do here in California. So there is precedent.
There is precedent, and California usually is a leader on smart policy. Unfortunately, in this instance, we're behind. Really, this is about protecting those in one of the most vulnerable positions that they'll ever be in their lives. And it's really trying to lift them up and make sure that they have as much relief and as much help from all different directions as possible.
John Harabedian, a California assemblyman, a Democrat who represents the district devastated by the Eaton fire. Assemblyman, thank you very much.
David, thank you.
Again, all of that, if you're lucky enough to have insurance from a company that pays. My house in Altadena burned up in that fire. We're fine, but I've been sharing what I'm learning on, for instance, Instagram. Go to Marketplace APM to see our updated video. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.